Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
So it was even at the end, which is fine. I'm glad it's even. There's no money that changes hands. That makes me happy. But Alan was great. He putted great, Michael.
He always putts great.
He putted like the Alan Bubis, who was, you know, who had to win the holes. And he did. He won the holes. And I left Gary in the lurch.
How would you describe Gary's face when you pumped the second one out of bounds? It's like
I didn't look. Let me just say, he was at my left. I did not look. I just said, play hard, partner. That's all I had.
This is General George Washington, and you're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
So let me go right to an email from Eric McKelvey in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I have been in my life, and I took the ferry multiple times from Dartmouth to Halifax. Enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed Nova Scotia. He writes, as a longtime listener of the podcast, I've enjoyed the many interviews with Chuck Culpepper over the years, and I'm now a regular reader of his work. I'm grateful for his excellent reporting and analysis, especially on golf and tennis, but also for something a bit more specific. You see, every time Chuck appears on the podcast, it seems to me he speaks with deep appreciation for the conversation. This is especially true as Tony wraps up the segment, and Chuck, before he hangs up, gives a heartfelt thank you so much, Tony. Words matter, but in this case, the tone in which they're said may matter more. So I guess this is a thank you for a thank you. Thank you to Chuck for reminding me of the importance of showing appreciation with a truly sincere thank you. And to Mr. Tony, thank you for your writing for PTI and for the podcast. You let us in on brilliant conversations, offer up unforgettable rants, and of course, provide endless laughs. That's very kind, and I appreciate that. But it leads me into something. Now, let me just say, if you can access the Washington Post, just get it and read Chuck Culpepper's story on Serena Williams today. Because it's great. This is a game story. The hardest thing to write being a newspaper sports writer is a game story. It's easy to write features. It's easy to write columns. The game story, reporting on what just happened and stitching it together in a way that is appealing, is the hardest thing to do. There's nobody who ever wrote for a newspaper who won't tell you this. Game stories, they separate the wheat from the chaff. And Chuck Culpepper is the wheat. He's the 100% whole wheat. It's a great story. And, you know, he's doing it. He's got a deadline. And he's stitching together wonderful phraseology. And he's giving you a look at the kernels of truth in the Serena Williams Harmony Tan match. The way he sets it up. It's just great. And it gets me to something else. We did PTI Live yesterday. We rarely do that. I mean, rarely do that. Wilbon was off. He had an engagement in Las Vegas, and Pablo was on. And Pablo's great. He's just great. But occasionally, like we've done 21 years of PTI, and 15, 20 times a year, we end up having to do the last segment live because something happens between our taping when we end at about 5:20 and 5:30. And so the happy segment ends up live. And that's for timing issues more than anything else. Because we have to correct something. Something just breaks. We have to change. But I can't remember doing the first block live. I mean, I can. I'm sure we've done it, but it's been a really long time.
And the first block would be the harder one to do live because it is more extemporaneous speaking and back and forth.
There's more stuff in it, more chance for a mistake. It is wider. It is not as confined as the other segments, and it's not written. You know, the happies, I write those.
Right.
And then the second person says whatever he wants, but there's a guide for that. The B segment, the game segment or the guest segment, that's easy to do. That's easy to do. The first segment is hard, the three stories that you talk about. So we went live yesterday because on ESPN was Wimbledon and the Serena Williams Harmony Tan match. And I watched a lot of Wimbledon yesterday because I watched Rafael Nadal. Rafael Nadal showed everyone in the world what championship DNA is made of. Now, I don't think Rafael Nadal can win Wimbledon. He hasn't won Wimbledon in 11 years. It's not his surface. He almost went out in the first round. And when in the first round, you're playing somebody nowhere close to your ability. When you're Rafael Nadal and you're seeded second, And he almost went out. He won the first two sets handily. He lost the third, and he was losing the fourth. And had he lost the fourth, there was a real good chance he would have gone out. This way, you know, again, not his surface. He was down 4-2 in the fourth set and won four in a row and won them big, won them by wide margins. With all his crazy OCD behavior, he came up large in the moment. This did not happen to Serena Williams. And she's got championship DNA as well. Of course she does. Might be the greatest female tennis player of all time. Certainly in the conversation among the top three. You'd never have a top three and not put her in. You just wouldn't do it. Okay, so she loses the first set to Harmony Tan, a Parisian woman who I had never heard of, who I found out is ranked 115th. I don't know how old she is, but if she's not in her teens, if she's older than 23 and she's ranked 115th, she's unlikely to ever win a major. Nigel, you would concur with that, right?
Absolutely.
You know, because she's had, you know, she's been around for a while. She's older than 23 and never ranked higher than that. So her age is important. And she was really good. She won the first set, I think it was 7-5. And the second set, Serena blew her out. It was 5-0 at one point. Serena lost the next game, but won after that. So it's 7-5, 6-1. And now Serena appears to be cruising. You know, it appears she's going to win. And she's up 4-2, I think, at one point, and then her serve is broken, and then it gets into a tiebreaker, and it's a weird tiebreaker. It's, what are you going to show me? She's 24, so she's unlikely to win a major at this point. I'd never heard of her at all. But she's very game, and she's moving Serena around, which is what you got to do. Serena hasn't played in a year. She hasn't played in a year. Her legs ache. Move her around. You can see between points, she's panting in the third set. But she's also great. Yes. She hits it 300 miles an hour. She can beat anybody. There's a 10-point tiebreaker. She goes out 4-love in the 10-point tiebreaker, and you think, okay, let's go. Let's go to work. This is going to end at about 5:25 or 5:15. We may be able to even take the ace, but it doesn't work that way. She loses the next five, I think. She ends up losing the tiebreaker. And it's a huge story because it's Serena Williams. It's her first time back in a year. And kids, it's possible. I'm not going to say probable. It's possible that's the last time she will ever play in Wimbledon, which is the most important tournament and her favorite tournament. It's possible it's the last time she'll ever play. And I think she'll probably play in the U.S. Open, but it's possible she could say, you know what? I'm 40. I don't want to go out in the first round at the U.S. Open. I'm done. It's possible. I don't know. She loses the match. It's a thrilling tennis match. And it's truly thrilling. Not because she lost, but because she gave everything that she had, and so did the other woman, Harmony Tan. I don't expect Harmony Tan to win this tournament. I don't. But it was really good. So it ends. It ends at about, I don't know, 5:28. We're geared up to go live now. It ends at about 5:28. We don't get on until about 5:33 or 5:34 because this is Wimbledon and you got to wrap it up and you got to send it to us. I just assumed we'd be on ESPN2 or ESPN News and we would have taped earlier. But they said, no, you can do the show. Now, when you're doing the show live, I'll check my time here. When you're doing the show live, at least when I'm doing the show live, I'm nervous. I'm still nervous. I don't want to say something wrong. I don't want to make a mistake. More than that, I don't want to say something that the people on Twitter are going to crush me for. I don't necessarily want that to happen. But we get through it, and we start, actually, we say, oh, we'll get to the Serena match in a moment, because she's third on our docket. Because we're a sports show. We're a general sports show. The Kyrie Irving thing's a bigger story to most people. And then that flows into the John Wall thing, which, you know, we'll ask David Aldridge about today. And then we get to Serena, and we don't really have notes. We're just talking. Pablo did say one great, just so brilliant. The Kyrie Irving quote about normal people, you know, get us through the day, but, you know, people who are different take us to tomorrow or whatever. And Pablo said it sounded like a cryptocurrency ad, which is a brilliant thing to say. But we're doing it live, and it makes me nervous. And I hope we did a good show. That's all I'm saying. I hope we did a good show. Because when it was over, there's a big exhale. Because you do the front end live, you do the back end live, the middle thing was taped, but that's a live show. You'll always know it's live because I will never get off the air without saying live TV ain't nothing like it. But I haven't had to say it in a long time, you know? So just for your information, if you liked the show, it was live. If you didn't like the show, it's probably because it was live, right?
Yeah, I actually love when you give us these peeks behind the curtain as to how you guys do the production going into PTI, because like we're right with you looking at the clock.
Yeah, like Eric Rideholm and Matt Kelleher are in your ear. We're going to have to go live. And then it's just a little bit different, because if there's a misfire with the equipment, if you're frozen, you don't have any idea.
Yeah, no.
On my end, I don't know what's going on the other end. I don't know that. Fortunately, all the equipment worked. Fortunately, Pablo and I got through it. Fortunately, Pablo's brilliant, you know, and can be funny and can go back and forth and stuff like that. And we made it in the right amount of time. But it was, and I don't want to say it was nerve-wracking. It's exhilarating, but it's scary at the same time.
Sure.
Scary.
Well, so, didn't you do all those Sid Caesar shows live?
No. Well, they did them. I didn't do them. I watched them. Yeah. I will get out of here. Who's first?
David Aldridge is
David
first.
David Aldridge. When we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Norwegian Soft Kitten. It's just such a great name. This is a song called Parody in Triplicate. And Glenn Burgoats, or Burgetts, and Alan Green, who are Norwegian Soft Kitten, write, it's a mess. We had a few chords for the song, some words. Then we started recording. When we ran out of words, Glenn started making chicken noises and laughing. We were too lazy to edit that stuff out. In Glenn's defense, he'd already eaten a lot of cottage cheese the day we recorded Small Curd, because Glenn has a discerning palate, so he was a bit loopy. Anyway, Alan threw in a quick bass riff and some drums, and we called it a day. Let's face it, we really phoned it in on this one. Sadly, Parody in Triplicate is still one of the better songs on our new album, so we're releasing it as a single. I just love them. Norwegian Soft Kitten, they play in David Aldridge. David Aldridge is now on working with The Athletic, and if you watch the PTI show, you will see that we, because we're newspaper guys, and we credit, you will see that we credit The Athletic, I think, David, more than any other news outlet. I really do. I mean, The Athletic seems to be on it all the time. And The Athletic was first, I guess, with the news that Kyrie Irving was going to exercise his $36.5 million option, as opposed to taking a $6 million deal with the Lakers. Of course he's going to do that. Of course he's going to do that, because he's crazy, but he's not an idiot, okay? Can you explain, the question is, can you explain Kyrie Irving? But nobody can. But can you explain your thoughts as to why he's there and what it means for the Nets?
Well, it's good news for the Nets in the sense that Kyrie is wildly talented, and certainly I don't know that he's worth the trouble, but he's certainly, you know, you understand why people constantly want to give him more opportunities on a basketball court, because he is otherworldly. But there's a lot of baggage that comes with that, Tony, as we all have seen over the last few years. So, at the end of the day, as you mentioned, we seem to all be shocked that the guy took $37 million instead of six. I don't know why we twisted ourselves into pretzels thinking that about that. But that's what Kyrie does, because of his, you know, just clear desire to be viewed as a contrarian and a deep thinker and somebody who's not, you know, doesn't go with the norm, and does this in a very public job where he gets paid $37 million a year. So I'm not sure he's the best spokesman for the contrarian point of view. Most contrarians live under bridges, but he does not. At the end of the day, it didn't make sense for him anyway to go to the Lakers, if you really look at it, if you really thought about it, other than, you know, reuniting with LeBron, but he's not reuniting with the LeBron he played with in Cleveland. He's reuniting with 37-year-old LeBron, who's still a very good player. Don't get me wrong; he's still a great player at times, but not the player he was 7 years ago when Kyrie left.
So, I'm going to credit Pablo with this because we did this yesterday on the PTI show, and Pablo called it the nuclear option. It's not mm-hmm. just Kyrie. If Kyrie leaves, and Kevin Durant, for whatever reason, Kevin Durant is under the spell of Kyrie Irving, which he seems to be, because nobody in their right mind would leave Steph Curry for Kyrie Irving. Nobody. It's just not possible that the Nets might have faced. They might not care about losing Kyrie, but they would care about losing Durant. Do you do you understand that relationship?
I think it comes down to those two guys are friends. They're friends. They're friends with each other. You know, how does your best friend become your best friend? I don't know. You know,
they just do, right?
You know, and so they are very close. They've become very close over the years. I think Kevin loves, that's too strong. Kevin also does not mind kind of being viewed as a contrarian and somebody that goes against the grain and claps back against perceived enemies in the media and things like that, you know. So they all kind of live on this precipice of being outraged by whatever was on First Take this morning, you know, and just like, and so, okay, you can live like that if you want, but they choose to live that way. And so they're kindred spirits in that realm. And so they wanted to play with each other, you know? And so, okay, all right. I mean, that's, you know, Steph and KD were never close personally. And right. part of that was because Steph was married and had kids and went home, you know, like he didn't hang out, you know, so that's part of it too. It was a functional relationship, but it wasn't a particularly close one. And so he wanted to try and win a championship with a friend of his that just happened to be one of the best point guards in the world, you know? So, that's as much as I can explain it. Cause if I try to be a psychologist, it's not my thing.
Yeah. I understand this. I mean, I think Kyrie is delusional. I love this quote: normal people keep the world going, but those who dare to be different lead us into tomorrow. I have no idea what that means. And he also had a quote.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm talking about. I'm this really, really deep thinker. And oh, by the way, I make $37 million a year.
The other quote is even better. When I say this was from April. When I say I'm here with Kevin Durant, I think that really entails us as managing this franchise together alongside Joe and Sean. Now, Joe is the owner, and Joe Tsai, and Sean Marks is the general manager. He completely, Kyrie Irving completely ignores there might be a coach. He doesn't need coaches. He's going to manage the entire franchise. And it leads to this question, David, and I like you, he's the best ball handler at getting to the basket I've ever seen. He is. He's the best.
Yeah. Yes.
I can't trust him for 10 seconds. I would never feel comfortable trusting him, right?
That is the problem. And that's why a lot of people in the league scratch their heads, because Kevin Durant is the ultimate baller. He wants to play all the time. He thinks, lives, drinks, sleeps, eats basketball. He loves the game. Like, he wants people who love the game as much as he does to be around him and be in his spirit and his aura and Kyrie, I think fair to one question how much Kyrie really loves playing basketball, because he seems to go to great lengths to not play it voluntarily, by the way, not because he's injured or anything like that. It's an odd pairing to be sure. It's certainly the Nets may have made it quite clear in their negotiations with Kyrie that they are not at all certain how much they can trust them, because they never even talked about a full 5-year max deal, which he was eligible for.
That's right.
It was always kind of like, well, we'll do, you know, a shorter deal. We'll do less money, but we're not going to give you the full boat because you haven't been here. You know, I mean, you haven't been around, you know? So it's tough to ask people to trust them. It's tough to ask a franchise that's really under the gun to kind of break through after 3 years of just really not doing anything. I mean, really, they haven't done anything in the postseason. They got to a conference semifinal, and that's it. And they lost that. You know what I mean? So they didn't even, they haven't been to a conference final, much less the finals. So this grand experiment of these two playing together has yielded nothing so
far. Right.
And so the Nets, to I think, understandably, have said, well, you know, let's not, we're not going to give, we'll give Durant the money because he shows up every day, you know, and puts up big numbers. But you, we're not going to do that.
They told him, try to make your own deal. It's okay. So I mean, there's no long term.
Yeah.
There's no long term there. There's no long term there.
Right.
You were
right.
Mentioning about people who haven't shown up for a while. John Wall comes to mind right now. John Wall in the last 5 years has basically not played. He's played 100 games and missed 300 games in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
The Houston Rockets paid him $44 million to not play. Now, mm-hmm. I mean, that's sortie tour money. I'm taking that. Everybody's taking that. $44 million to not play. Now he's going to make $47 million this year. 41 of it is going to come from the Rockets who bought him out, and 6 of it is going to come from the Clippers. He is in a really good position. David, you know that I've never been a fan of John Wall's because I've always thought that he used his greatest asset, speed, to not help the other people on the team. He just sort of ran in front of everybody all the time. But there's no question that when John Wall was healthy and young, he had real talent. What?
Yes.
Can you get it 5 years basically on the shelf? Are there any fears that he'll be able to play?
Well, I mean, he'll play, but the question is, will he be good? You know, and nobody, I don't think anybody expects him to be, you know, the John Wall from 2016 or 2017 when he was relatively healthy and was, you know, an elite point guard in the NBA. Question is, could he come in and be a good rotational piece on a really good Clippers team, right?
Yeah.
If the assumption is Kawhi will be back next year and Paul George will be back next year, they're really, really good. I don't think he can start on that team because I think Reggie Jackson's earned that, right, the last 2 years.
Okay.
And I think, no, I don't even think John, who famously dissed Reggie Jackson's contract a few years ago, if you remember. That's going to be an interesting locker room dynamic.
Right, right.
I don't think even John would say, I should come in and start over Reggie Jackson, who has earned playing time the last 2 years, playing very well for the Clippers. But can John be a great sixth man coming off the bench and leading their second unit? I think he still has very much can do that, has the capability of doing that. So, yeah, he could do it. Physically, where is he? I don't know. Tony, I don't know. He hadn't played in 2 years. He hadn't played in three years, really.
Yeah,
he hadn't played. So I don't know. The last time he played, which was two seasons ago for the Rockets.
40 games. Big numbers.
Solid numbers.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, the numbers are fine.
Yes, he did.
So he can play. John can get his 8 assists in his sleep. You know what I mean? Like, that is not the issue at all. The issue is, can he guard anybody? Does he want to guard anybody? Is he going to be in shape? And can he make enough shots, you know, off from deep to earn his keep, to earn his minutes? So those are the questions. But can John help them? Yeah, he could help them, sure. Absolutely.
It's an interesting thing to me. He's like an astronaut who went to the moon and stayed on the moon for 4 or 5 years. I mean, you know, he'll be 32 when the season starts. His entire resume starts with the word speed. I don't know if he's still going to have that speed. I don't know if he can learn to sort of integrate his skills with their skills, although God knows Kawhi Leonard is a great basketball player. Paul George may not be as good as he thinks he is, but he's real good.
Awfully good, yes.
So that, all of a sudden, that team looks like, and I hate to say this, the Brooklyn of the West. Just right, David?
I think that's an accurate comparison. Yes, I would say so. Sure. Now, their issues have been injuries. That's been their problem the last 2 years.
Right.
Is that they've had real debilitating season-long injuries to deal with their most important players, Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. I mean, you can't.
That's right.
You can't get around that. I mean, it's an ACL, and it's, you know, those are serious injuries, and Kawhi missed the whole season last year. But all indications are they should be back and healthy next year. And when those two were together and playing, really good. The Clippers were a really, really good basketball team, as you would expect. And I would expect going forward, you know, forget John, they should just be right back at the top of the discussion in the West next year.
So let us move to one other person, because the common thread here, Kyrie Irving getting $36.5 million, John Wall getting $47 million, Russell Westbrook opted in. Of course he opted in. Of course he did. Someone is going to pay him $47
million. It's a stunning development, yes.
Yeah. He opted in. I watched Russell Westbrook on the Wizards and thought, man, the guy gives 100% effort all the time. He's really great. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer. His numbers will get him there. Yeah. Pablo pointed out something to me yesterday that he excels on teams that don't win, but teams that do win, he may not. Now, he was on a team that won in Oklahoma City. It didn't, you know, I mean, that got to the finals. But it is possible that he's one of those guys that can't win with a lot of talent around him because he needs the ball. It did not work at all with the Lakers. It's hard for me to imagine, David, that he can go through another season with LeBron James like this, right?
I you know, I had hoped that the pursuit of the legitimate chance to win a championship with LeBron James and Anthony Davis would compel Russell to kind of understand he had to change a little.
He didn't.
Not a lot, Tony, just a little, and he didn't change at all. Now, part of that was I don't think he respected, and this is always the issue with Russ, I don't think he respected the coach at all. We will see if he respects Darvin Ham. The only way we can know that is to see them in games together and see how that works. But he did clearly clashed with Frank Vogel. But, you know, it's just such a difficult with him and LeBron because they both have to have the basketball
always
for them to be at their best.
Yes.
And they're both really good with the basketball in their hands, by the way. Like, you know, look, you know, is not a terrible point guard. He's a scoring point guard. He's going to look to score most of the time, but he does pass it. It's not like he doesn't pass it at all. But he has to have the ball, Tony. He is not a guy that's going to spot up and go to the opposite corner and wait. It's just not. It's never been his game. It's not his game today. It's not ever going to be his game. And so, how do he and LeBron play together on a basketball court? I still don't know how they do it. There's lots of, you know, theories about, well, just put him in the dunker spot and he can screen and all those. Yeah, all that sounds nice, but try to. Let's have that meeting with Russell Westbrook where you tell him, yeah, I need you to screen away. And then just, you know, you're not going to touch the ball for multiple possessions and you'll catch it on the third rotation. You know, like, come on, he's not going to go for that. And so I don't know any other way but to stagger their minutes as much as possible, which means Russell has to come off the bench, which is another good conversation that I'd be very curious to be there when you tell Russell Westbrook he's coming off the bench, right? Making $47 million. So it's a tough sell. I'm quite skeptical that it could ever work between the two of them. And I don't think it's personal. I just think it's the way that they both play. It would be the same as if, you know, Chris Paul was playing with LeBron. He needs the ball, Tony. Like, that's what Chris Paul does. He's a guy that has to have the ball in his hands to be effective. So, but so does LeBron. And LeBron's shown how great he can be with the ball in his hand and with players that can make shots around them. So I understand why the Lakers lean into LeBron on that.
It's so weird to me. Russell Westbrook, you know, he has more triple-doubles than anybody in history. He is a machine, a statistics machine. But he has taken the big heat for this. Everybody has blamed Russell Westbrook for this. Blame the Lakers. Don't blame Russell. I'm not even saying blame LeBron. Blame the fact that you cannot put these two people on the court together. It's crazy. Well, so
I would say LeBron has to take some responsibility for this because he advocated for this trade.
That's right.
And they have to do what LeBron says. So they, you know, I don't think, you know, they had a trade on the table which would have gotten them Buddy Hield, which would have been a much better fit with LeBron than Russell, just because Buddy Hield's a great shooter, an elite-level shooter. And so if LeBron sucks the defense to one side, Buddy Hield's going to be wide open to the other. And that deal was basically done, and LeBron said, hey, wait, let's do Westbrook instead. And they did, and it didn't work. So LeBron's got to own that too. But everybody else has got to own it. You know, Rob Pelinka's got to own it. Jeannie Buss has to own it. LeBron has to own it.
Absolutely. Thank you, David. Thank you. Thank you. David Aldridge, okay, boys Tony. And girls, having his own David Aldridge moment every moment of his life. We'll take a break. Steve Sands will join us. When we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in. The one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with signature vintage wash sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, signature vintage wash sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived-in feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, signature vintage wash sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show. The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Hideki Matsuyama, with his majors win in 21, is probably the greatest golfer from the land of the rising sun. But the very first Japanese golfer to win on the PGA. And no, sir, it's no joke, he was named Isao Aoki. In 80, Jack Nicklaus won the Masters by two strokes. He, the tournament record broke, he beat Isao Aoki. In 04 at the Hall of Fame, in a ceremony hardly low-key, the commissioner stood and spoke, he, honoring Isao Aoki. The very first Japanese golfer to win on the PGA, and no sir, it's no joke, he was named Isao Aoki.
Dan Byrne, brilliant, who writes, I had to write a song about Isao Aoki after he kept coming up in crossword puzzles I was doing. I'm sure you understand. Right? Right? Plays yes. In Steve Sands, who's covered all of these people. Let us start with this. The first Saudi Tour event in the United States is upcoming, beginning tomorrow, I believe. It's in Oregon. What are your thoughts and expectations about? It's different. It's not London. It's not. It's different when it's in the United States, I think, but maybe I'm wrong.
I love the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Yeah.
Love to do it every day. I've never once had any kind of thought that goes through the mind of Dan Byrne. Amazing. Just absolutely remarkable, Dan. Pumpkin Ridge. So Tiger Woods won one of his three U.S. amateurs at Pumpkin Ridge. Pumpkin Ridge has a long, storied past. The U.S. Women's Open was played there as well. Going head-to-head against a PGA Tour event tomorrow, Tony, that's going to be something. And it's also going to be streaming at the same time that the PGA Tour television window is going on. There's another, you know, caveat to that. They've got a few more players than the last time we spoke from the PGA Tour, Patrick Reed, Brooks Koepka, Matthew Wolff, Carlos Ortiz, Pat Perez, making their debuts. I don't know. There's a lot of momentum on that side right now, Tony. A lot of momentum for LIV Golf.
The PGA Tour event this week is the John Deere. Right. I always make fun of the John Deere. It's not the Masters, the John Deere. It's really not. Do you think that's deliberate on the Saudi Tour to just go against the John Deere?
I think the way they set their schedule, Tony, was made more because of the way the major championships throughout the calendar were set. I think they wanted to go, you know, against certain events. And certainly I think the John Deere Classic was ripe for LIV Golf to go head-to-head against.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no question that it was done on purpose in that regard. There's another week. The Scottish Open is next week. Now, that's a co-sanctioned event between the PGA Tour and what was the European Tour. It's called the DP World Tour now. And the DP World Tour announced last week that they would not allow the LIV Golf guys to play in that Scottish Open because it's co-sanctioned by the PGA Tour. So when you originally look at the schedule, Tony, if you play this week, then you essentially had a chance to play next week before going to St. Andrews and the Open Championship, which is the following week. That's probably why they set the schedule for the Portland event to go head-to-head against the John Deere Classic this week.
Okay. You mentioned Pumpkin Ridge. It's a name that I remember.
Yeah.
What happens if you're an American golf course and you say to the Saudi Tour, you can play here. We'll welcome you. You can play here. Down the road, what do you think the PGA Tour does? Do they take vengeance on those courses and never put an event there?
I think vengeance is a little light. Maybe they take a flamethrower to the entire operation. I don't think it's a mistake at all that if you remember, like, say, 5-6 years ago, remember Doral? Remember how big Doral used to be on the PGA
yes.
Tour?
Yes.
And do you remember who bought Doral?
I'm just trying to take a guess. It was Donald Trump.
Correct. And then do you remember what happened to the Doral event that had a PGA Tour event every year since, like, you know, 1748?
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. It went over the wall and was played in Mexico, was the joke on the PGA Tour. LIV Golf is going to be hosted by two Donald Trump courses.
That's right.
One of them in Bedminster and one of them at Doral later this year. I don't think it's any mistake that he got involved with the LIV Golf because he feels like he was burned by the PGA Tour however many years ago it was, 5 or 6 years ago when they left Doral after all those years. Pumpkin Ridge probably would never be able to host a PGA Tour event anyway just because of infrastructure and logistics. The size of the golf course, it's not a big golf course. They've never had a PGA Tour event there. The others probably will never have a chance either anymore. I don't think the PGA Tour has any interest whatsoever in any of the golf courses that are in the United States anyway that are going to be hosting these LIV Golf events, not only because they don't love the golf courses, Tony, but also because now that they've gotten in bed with LIV, the PGA Tour will have right. nothing to do with them.
You mentioned Brooks Koepka. The big catch originally was Phil Mickelson, then Brooks Koepka. He's got 4 majors. I mean, he's a guy. Now, Matthew Wolf, Carlos Ortiz, Pat Perez, I don't know that they have any impact, but I take it from what you said that you think that, you know, the Saudi Tour is taking a lot of eggs out of the basket of the PGA, and it's beginning to mount up.
Yes and no, if it's possible to have both of those in the same answer. Yes, they are continuing with the slow drip of players going over there. Does Carlos Ortiz make a difference to the American audience as far as the field and television viewing and Pat Perez and Matthew Wolf? No, not even Patrick Reed per se, and probably not even Brooks Koepka per se. Brooks has 4 majors, but is he a big star on the PGA Tour?
No.
No. You could argue that he's not based upon, you know, his personality and how much he gives to the audience. You would probably say no. I still think, Tony, that there hasn't, and maybe I'm wrong, and you and Michael and the others could say the other side. They haven't gotten anybody yet who has been a surprise. They haven't gotten anybody yet who is of the core star, young stud on the PGA Tour, meaning right. Colin Morikawa, these 5, Colin Morikawa, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas, and Jordan Spieth.
Right.
If you got one of those 5, Tony, that would be a shocker to everybody in golf and sports. They haven't gotten anybody yet who you think, oh, wow, I can't believe he went. And if that happens, then maybe the narrative changes. But until that happens, I think that the slow drip of the players who they are getting, who by the way, are world-class players, but they're basically, you know, depth of field players, you know, guys who you think are going to play a PGA Tour event you might see on TV or might see in person if you're in town that particular week. But if they get one of those other five guys, that to me changes the narrative. But so far, they've gotten everybody who most people thought would go and do it.
I thought, and made this comment on television last week when it was announced that Nick Faldo was stepping away from CBS, I said it wouldn't surprise me at all if you saw him with a national television deal doing the Saudi tour. Well, I read in Golf Magazine yesterday that he said, there's no way I'm going to do this. And he ripped the tour and he said, you know, Norman and I are not friends. And no, I don't expect to ever do that. Did that surprise you at all, the strength of his comments?
The only reason it didn't, Tony. And you can appreciate this, is...
You know him.
Not only do we know Nick, I've been at dinner with him a bunch in the last, like, 6 weeks. And he told us a couple months ago that he was doing that, that he was going to retire. It just wasn't announced until last week. And he was the first person to tell me something that I had not yet heard from any player or former player about Liv. I was in the booth with him about 3, maybe 4 weeks ago at the Memorial, at Jack Nicklaus's Memorial Tournament. And we were all at dinner. But not all of us, but a few of us were at dinner. And he was saying, it's an exhibition to him. It's not
competition.
That's what
he said. That's right. That's right.
It's not competition. And he said this, there's no cameras around. This is us, you know, a couple glasses and a big steak in front of us talking about it. And Nick kept saying, and I kept saying to him, Nick, are you telling me if you were Nick Faldo in the 80s and 90s, number one player in the world, and you had an opportunity to get $100, $150, $200 million, you wouldn't do it? He said, I'm telling you, I know it's hypothetical, but I'm telling you I wouldn't do it because it's not competition to him. It's an exhibition. It's 48 guys, the same 48 guys, playing in a shotgun start over 54 holes, not 72 holes. And he said none of it sits well with him from a competitive standpoint. He said, of course the money is outrageous. And at certain points in certain careers, yes, go ahead and take the money. If you're Lee Westwood, Phil Mickelson, you're 49 and 52 years of age, Ian Poulter, Pat Perez, upper 40s, these guys can't compete against the PGA Tour players anymore. Take the money. Get out of here. If you're Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, you know, any of these young guys, Carlos Ortiz, Matthew Wolf, to Nick Faldo, who is one of the great competitors of all time, six majors, Hall of Fame, great, great player. He said, no thanks. He said, I just wouldn't do it. I think I'd get bored. I know I'd have all the money in the world, but that's not why you get into it in the first place. He doesn't begrudge them for taking the money. He's just saying in his case, he thinks competitively it just wouldn't get his juices flowing whatsoever, and he wouldn't do it.
It's interesting. I read the quotes and I was very interested. I'll get you out of here on this.
The answer is no. There was no way he was going to take a job with golf. But he told us that a long time ago. When I read that last week or the other day, I kind of chuckled.
Just on this notion, you were at the Hartford tournament last week, I assume. And I felt bad for Thagala. I mean, you know, and that would have been a nice win. That would have been a really nice win. Is that traumatizing? I guess he's too young to be traumatized by that because he hadn't won before to put it in the sand and you know, double the last hole, almost make the putt. But what happens to him in the near future, do you think?
He's a really, really good player. And by the way, he's a terrific kid.
Great talker.
He's a great talker. He's a great talker, Tony. He's really accessible. He's really nice kid. His father's always out there kind of cheering and having fun in a really good way, not getting in the way. We've seen people in tennis and golf and other parents of other sports do the same thing. Sahith Thagala's father's not like that. He's fantastic. So is Sahith. We've talked about this before, Tony. There's a word in golf that you hear often when things like this happen. It's called scar tissue.
Yeah.
And scar tissue builds in sports, especially in individual sports. Happens in tennis at Grand Slams. It happens in golf all the time. He came close to winning in Phoenix, in Scottsdale, the WM Phoenix Open. had a bad break there on the 71st hole, and then lost in a playoff. And then what happened to him on Sunday was his own fault. He shouldn't have hit a driver. He should have hit 3-wood. But you learn through mistakes. You know, I've talked to so many professional athletes over the years, especially in golf, who will tell you that the best players, that the ones who are the toughest mentally, are the ones who learn through adversity, learn through mistakes, learn through losses. That they remember the losses more than they remember the wins. And I think Sahith will be perfectly fine. He'll understand what happened there on the 72nd hole. And you've got to slow down. You've got to have the right choice when you're up one and you're going to hit a driver in a certain spot versus a 3-wood. He didn't get away with it. He lost. And I think he'll learn from it. He's a really nice kid, like I said. He's also a very smart kid, has a high golf acumen. I think Sahith will be perfectly fine, and you would love him, Tony. Not only is he a great talker, but he's just a bright young man who's got a lot of wherewithal about him outside of just golf. He's a fantastic kid, and I think he's going to be a big credit to the PGA Tour for a long time. But he needs to get that first win out of the way, because Sunday was painful. That was a very, very difficult loss.
Thank you, Steve. Talk soon, I know.
You got it, Tony. Good luck with those pencils and the scorecards. It was real easy to get those at a U.S. Open on a Sunday morning, Tony. It was fantastic.
I appreciate it very much once I get them in my hand. Steve Sands, boys and girls. We'll take a break. We will have email and jingle when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
He's orange and balding, what takes that a scalding? No need to send tribute, he has cash to spare. But if you throw down for sweets from your hometown, a big box of that, you can feel free to share. Gummy bears, 12 different flavors if you really care, that Haribo crap simply can't compare to Albany's gummy bears. It's not a mystery that Tone's got a history of searching for cottage cheese and grapefruit juice. Waistlines are growing, so take pride in knowing you said they're the best. Now we all know it's true. Gummy bears, the big bad Carol stuck her face in there. On sale now at Safeway and everywhere. You think to buy gummy bears, Albany's gummy.
All right, there's a story behind this, obviously. That's Jerry Negrelli singing, and yes. Elliot Olshansky provided the lyrics. Ever since Jared, the gummy bear guy, wrote in from Terre Haute to proclaim the superiority of Albany's to Haribo, I found myself humming the theme from the late 80s Disney cartoon series, Adventures of the Gummy Bears. I doubt you ever saw it. I did not. But the Oregon Trail generation has fond memories of the show and its theme song, which was sung by Joseph Williams, son of John Williams, yes, that John Williams, who went on to become the lead singer of Toto and the singing voice of the adult Simba in The Lion King. As a result, I was able to recruit Jerry Negrelli to record my rewrite of the theme, although he finished before I could rewrite the lyrics to include mention of the champagne gummy bears that Sansi showed you. Best regards from Suffolk County, where I too have discovered the wonders of Albany's gummy bears, having procured them at Stop and Shop, ShopRite, and Five Below. It's a great song that Jerry sang.
Yes.
We need Jared to send us more Albany's gummy bears.
Right. Have you tried the gummy worms?
I've never really liked gummy worms. They're too much to chew on.
Yeah, but there's more flavor.
Yeah, I've been a gummy bears guy. Anyway, you want to do the Bethesda Bagels?
Bethesda Bagels, we love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com, forward a location in the D.C. area nearest you, then pop on in, and you'll be thrilled.
So that's about it for us today. Before we get to the mailbag, let me just say, Spider Murphy played the tenor saxophone. Little Joe was blowing on the slide trombone. The drummer boy from Illinois went crash, boom, bang. The whole rhythm section was the Purple Gang. That's probably Elvis Presley, kids.
Yes.
That's my guess.
Yes.
What's the name of that song? Jailhouse Rock.
Yeah, Let's Rock. Everybody, Let's Rock.
Thanks to our guests today, David Aldridge, Steve Sands. Thanks to today's sponsors, MeUndies, Solo Stove, X-Chair. You should listen to the MeUndies read because we interrupted a couple of times. And remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. From Shad, a haiku. Sauntering around, belly full of daylilies, eat it, Kornheiser. No, eat it, deer. The deer ate it. He or she, probably a she. Probably she. You don't see bucks around. You see does around a lot.
Sure.
A ruck from the Soviet Safeway. That's not my Safeway.
That's not the refugee Safeway. No. That's a different Safeway.
One deer question.
That's off 17th
Did the deer have
Street.
One of your yes. day lilies behind its ear? That would be so funny. From Patrick Sitter in Sioux Falls,
sleeve.
South Dakota. Elvis is still alive, and he's using your easy pass. Sweet revenge.
That's who it is.
From Matthew in Greensboro, North Carolina. I've been fascinated by your recent discussions on Elvis since you, like Bob Ryan to the sport of basketball, have seen nearly all of the great acts of popular American music over the past 65 years or so. I specifically remember your May 13th, 2020 episode. It was your first episode after Little Richard passed, and your discussion about him, Chuck Berry, and Bo Diddley and their distinct sounds was one of my favorite segments you've done. I just have a question, being a millennial and all, as I was curious of someone who saw them all. Who, in your opinion, was the biggest musical superstar? I figure the triumvirate is a debate among Elvis, the Beatles, and Michael Jackson. But since you saw all of them and are an avid fan of music, I wanted to get your opinion on this. I figured it was Michael Jackson. I would have said the Beatles. Because of my age when the Beatles came into prominence.
Sure.
I was a little too young for Elvis. I was a little too old for Michael Jackson, and I would have said the Beatles. Tony Beeson has sent a photo of himself at the Safeway, at the refugee Safeway. Sometimes in life, there's a perfect confluence of events which lead to something amazing. Fellow Little Lee Gordon and I made a pilgrimage to the refugee Safeway during this past weekend's Jingle Fest event and came across an Ingleside van in the Safeway
yep.
parking
Can't
lot.
Can't miss it. Yep.
It's just so great. That's yep. just so wonderful.
Did he say hi to Saka?
Chad is writing now, and he's not just doing haikus. At the Jingle Golf event on Friday, a donation was made to the golf course to anonymously pay for the rounds of junior golfers. We call it Jingle Golf It Forward. At future Jingle Golf tournaments, we will continue to raise money, and each golfer will get the chance to make the same type of donation at their local course. Little's helping Little's golfers. That's very nice.
Isn't that nice?
From Steve Lipton. Yes, I returned home safely from Jingle Fest. Thank you for asking. Below is a picture of the 2022 Jingle Fest jinglers holding a Stonehenge prop and giving our TK salutes. KJ Onstad, Tony Beeson, Steve Lipton, Jerry and Michelle Negrelli, Joe Harrow, Louis Crocco, and Megan Kelly Crocco. And it's just wonderful, and I pass that around
yes.
the table here.
And by the way, because I guess you said that on the show, I hope everyone gets home safely.
Yes.
So we've had about 500 emails from Littles who said I got home safely. Good. So thank you for
Phil
all
Phil West in Lexington, Kentucky. I must confess to the following. During my senior year of high school in the small town of Harrisburg, Illinois, not Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I mistakenly committed some light election fraud. Let me explain. One Tuesday in the spring of 2013, there was a local election being held. Side note, our high school gym was a county polling place, a fact whose importance will soon become apparent. I was doing the morning announcements at our high school and ended the announcements by encouraging eligible students and teachers to vote for a fellow senior who was running for our town library board. A vote for Jose Durbin is a vote for literacy, I proudly exclaimed. As soon as I finished the sentence, our principal immediately cut off the intercom and shouted at me incredulously. What are you doing? You can't do that. I was very confused until he explained to me that the intercom also extended to our high school gym, where crowds of county voters were gathered, all of whom could hear my announcement. He further explained this was illegal electioneering and that the results of our entire county election could be nullified, which is
sure.
totally true.
Yep.
Fortunately, my misdeed was short-lived after a call to the State Board of Elections in Springfield reassured our county board of elections that we were in the clear since there's no way a kid could intentionally be that stupid. Literacy lost the day as Jose Durbin lost his race. As an afterward, Jose now works as a campaign staffer for Darren Bailey, an Illinois Republican candidate for governor. I like to think that somewhere in central Illinois, Jose will listen and hear this and experience a David Aldrich moment of his own, hanging Chad edition. Also, thanks for reading. I must go now. Large curds await. Ted in Richmond. Would Moses Malone be a good pitch man for X Chair? He does like those numbers. Moses isn't alive. Moses isn't with us anymore.
No longer signing.
He's not signing. Sorry. Dylan Vandergriff. Dear Mr. Tony, on your latest episode, I had a listener write in from Atlanta, Texas, and had my first David Aldridge moment. While I live in Tyler, Texas now, I am from a small town called Maud, which is about 10 minutes from Atlanta, and I've had many a meal in that small town. Anyway, tell Blaine from Atlanta, and he's not the only little around East Texas. Thanks for the amazing content and making me a miserable Nats fan just like yourself. And one more. Two more. Joe Rudden in Mount Airy, Maryland. Normally, I would try to write something smart or funny and usually fail. I'm not even going to try. Just going to say Jessica Mitchell. I mean, come on. What are we talking about? How great is she? When she wins a Grammy, I hope she shouts Lachiserie. I actually went to Alexa the other day and asked to get Jessica Mitchell, and I couldn't. I mean, she was on some sort of paywall situation.
Oh, okay.
One more. Jay Devine in Montreal. Missing clutch golf shots and your grandkid's fifth birthday on the same weekend. That's how you double down. I'll sit back and listen to the emails about this forever. Let me just tell you something.
It's more that you campaigned to bring the other grandfather with you.
So
I set up a trip.
I felt we were safe at that point because we were both there,
sure,
and nobody could get blamed.
Yeah.
I went out yesterday to play golf. I took so many shots in the sand. I mean, after three misses in the sand, I just picked up.
Sure.
I mean, just three misses. I did that on six different holes. I shot over 100 yesterday, and that's a gift over 100 because I just picked up. I can't get out of the sand.
You probably pick up some distance if you use this technique off the tee.
That's my punishment. You know, I'm hitting the ball. I'm not hitting the sand. I'm being punished for missing Bootsy's birthday.
Yeah.
And, yes, appropriating Chan to leave with me. Figuring there was strength in numbers. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
We'll be right back. Hideki Matsuyama, with his majors win in 21, is probably the greatest golfer from the land of the rising sun. But the very first Japanese golfer to win on the PGA, and no sir, it's no joke, he was named Isao Aoki. In 80, Jack Nicklaus won the Masters by 2 strokes. He, the tournament record broke. He beat Isao Aoki. In 04, at the Hall of Fame, in a ceremony hardly low-key, the commissioner stood and spoke. He, honoring Isao Aoki. The very first Japanese golfer to win on the PGA, and no sir, it's no joke, he was named Isao Aoki. Da 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 da